It would be foolish to tell somebody as an immigrant not to learn the English language. Mm. It is through the English language that they can enter fully, socially, culturally, politically, this culture. But it would be equally foolish to tell them that in the process of acquiring the English language, give up your Spanish. There is no doubt in my mind that as we move deeper in into the 21st century, the bilinguals are going to win.
That's Elon Stavins, my guest for this episode. In our conversation, you'll see why I describe him as a Tocqueville for our time. Like Tocqueville, Elon came to America as an outsider, and he has an uncanny knack for understanding the trajectory of our country. I'm going to ask you about what I call your language biography. So tell us, what languages were you born into?
I was born into an immigrant enclave in Mexico. My grandparents were Eastern European, Yiddish-speaking Jews that were running away from pogroms and from poverty. And some of them wanted to come to the United States because America was iconic, the land of opportunity, but they faced immigration quotas. So some of them were temporarily stationed in the Caribbean, in Central America, and eventually made their way to Mexico. The environment was multilingual, and I didn't pay attention to it. I would speak Yiddish in certain circumstances with my grandparents. And then, boom, I would leave that room and start playing soccer with the kids across the street. And now it was Spanish that we spoke. And when we would enter synagogue, we would switch to Hebrew. Because, you know, when you are growing up in a multilingual environment and you're a little kid, you don't know that the rest of the world isn't just like you at this particular moment. And so I thought the entire Mexico spoke Yiddish and Hebrew.
What a pleasure and honor it is to finally be with you. So if you wouldn't mind, would you just say your name and whatever title you fancy at the moment?
Elon Stavins, Professor of Humanities, Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College, the publisher of Restless Books, and a consultant to the Oxford English Dictionary.
And that's just half the day. And not even half the story. There is, for example, the many books he has written or co-written, the literature he has translated from Spanish and Yiddish and Hebrew and English, and his work as what I would call a cultural linguist.
The question I really want to ask you after going through a short litany of what you produced, is there a common theme to what you do?
Such a question, Steve, truly. My gut feeling is to say, let others try to figure that out. There will come a time when my hands might not work the way they do. My mind might be slower. It's just a spark of consciousness that we have, and it doesn't last long. And I want to feel that I was not caged or imprisoned by one particular topic. I rather take a generalist approach. But that generalist approach, as you know, sometimes comes with the backlash of, who are you to be talking about American English when you just arrived here 20, 30 years ago?
And I might say, who better than an outsider like Tocqueville saw early United States that our own countrymen could not?
Absolutely. The immigrant has that quality of being an outsider, showing you something that hopefully or probably insiders don't see.
Thanks for joining me in my conversation with an American Tocqueville, that famous 19th century author of Democracy in America, or to say it more correctly, a Mexican Yiddish American. I'm Steve Levine, and this is America the Bilingual.
When were you first exposed to English?
Like the vast majority of people in the world simply by turning the television on or by putting the radio and listening to the music that was arriving from New York or the movies that were coming from Hollywood. There is no one in Latin America, no matter how monolingual you might be, that is not exposed to English in some ways because of popular culture.
But Elon followed a unique path of coming to English.
My father was a soap opera actor and for many years lived off dubbing cartoons and
soap opera in Mexico.
Soap opera in
telenovelas.
Mexico, telenovelas. Uh-huh. And so I would know that a television show was being spoken in Spanish, but I could see that the lips moved in one way and the sound came off in a strange way.
You mean your father was a voice actor as well?
Absolutely.
His father dubbed movies, television shows, even some cartoons. Remember the Flintstones?
Fred and Barney. What do they sound like in Spanish?
It was always fascinating because, you know, the dubbing in Mexico is not the same as the dubbing in Argentina or the dubbing in Spain. So each country had its own dubbing industry.
Then there was that indelible moment when dubbing caused Elon to boldly go where he'd never gone before.
I particularly remember Star Trek being dubbed into Spanish, and I remember that millisecond between Spock uttering a word and then the sound coming a little later. Uh-huh. And to me, living in translation, living a multilingual life, sometimes is about that millisecond that you have to wait to register. What language is coming to me right now? Is it an authentic language? Is it being dubbed? Is it being translated?
That wasn't the only moment when Elon and his family would go where they hadn't been. When Elon's family immigrated to the U.S. in 1985, his facility with English accelerated. But even for someone who was comfortable moving from one language to another, there were challenges.
I could not avoid having an inferiority complex, like all immigrants do, of saying, oops, I might have as many sharp ideas as everybody else, but I can't utter them. You are undressed in front of others. Uh-huh.
And you've lived now in the United States longer than you've lived anywhere else.
Correct. Absolutely.
So are you now English dominant?
I'm English dominant, but not fully an English insider. I feel that to me, English is a rented home that I love and have decorated and feel very much like my place, but it is not mine. And I have to prove to the owner that that I am worthy of living in it.
Wow. Does that explain why you've written so many books and so many exceptionally approachable books?
Well, I truly thank you for your generosity. I do think that the immigrant mentality is one that says, I have to prove myself, especially in the eyes of the insiders. And proving oneself might have to do with productivity.
So you have done so much. You've written so many books. I don't even know how many. Do you keep count?
I don't even know how many myself. I don't count.
Well, we did count and came up with more than 50 books that Elon has authored or co-authored. I think he's proved himself. Elon also has a talent for compiling the work of others, including his recent book, The People's Tongue: Americans and the English Language. And just an aside, Elon became one of those Americans himself in the 1990s. I asked him about something he wrote in the book, namely, that English has become the planet's lingua franca and everyone's favorite second language.
And you point out that for every American English speaker, there are a dozen or more non-native speakers of English. So what gives with English? Is it no longer ours?
I am intrigued by the question of ownership in language. There's a beauty in coming from the outside to a language. You don't feel that ownership, but you feel that you have a romance with that language. You choose that language.
For all that English has, it lacks what French, Italian, and Spanish have, a governing body to watch over the language and protect it.
The academies, the Académie Française, or Academia de la Crusca in Italy, or the Royal Academy.
Or the Royal Academy
of the Spanish language. I am convinced that in the 450 million Spanish speakers, we have dozens, if not hundreds, of different ways of using the Spanish language that are as legitimate and authentic as the one from the Royal Academy in central Madrid. And that centralized view that the dictionary has to come from central Spain to let us all, Latin Americans, know how the Spanish language is used is absolutely outmoded. It doesn't belong to the 21st century.
So tell me about that. Why don't they just close up shop there at the Cervantes Institute?
I have proposed that and have gotten myself in deep trouble. I hope they don't close shop because I won't have an enemy. It's good to have an antagonist.
While Professor Staven certainly knows the rules of English, he admires how frequently they are ignored. He approves of what he calls linguistic pollution.
I love when words overstep their space and their duty and have love affairs with other words that create middle grounds.
You're going to have to come up with an example now after that introduction.
Well, when you think, for instance, of a frenemy.
A frenemy,
it's a word that many young people use right now.
And it's so perfect. It's one of those words you go, huh? And then you go, oh.
Oh, why didn't we have that before? Or hangry.
Hangry, yes.
It's another beautiful word. It may, you know,
I'm so hungry, I'm angry, yes. I'm hangry.
It's very easy, particularly for those of us who have some authority or are perceived to have some authority to legislate what is not right for language. And who are we to say that hangry or frenemy is wrong? If there is a need for such a word, then the word has a space.
Yeah.
And it might at first be seen as bad, ugly, unwelcome, but eventually makes it to the overall vocabulary because that's what words do. They find their own space.
In his book, The People's Tongue, he describes Americans as having an allergy to authority. He also points out another allergy Americans have.
Allergy toward authority and allergy toward foreign languages.
You wrote that the history of linguistic xenophobia in America is intense.
Intense, indeed. Because we have, I think in part, Steve, as a result of our geography, we have water on two sides. We have a country to the north that is English-speaking and French-speaking. And to the south, I can't think of a part of the world where two countries share a border that are so unlike each other, where immigrants have played a role, starting with the settlers who are indeed, it's a synonym of immigrant, a settler. We have benefited tremendously and ongoingly from outsiders rebuilding, reinventing this country time and again. We have this allergy to the languages that they brought with them, Spanish, German, Yiddish, Russian, French, Italian, you name it. And our paradigm is lose that language and become fully fluent in English. That's what is going to be proof of your loyalty, of your assimilation. What a loss. We need those languages.
So many people alive today can tell stories about their parents or grandparents that actively discouraged the use of their heritage language, their home country, the old world language, and forced their children and sometimes themselves to speak English, even if it was broken, to become a full American and as American as the people next door. Do you think that Americanization is softening now? Do you think that bilingualism may be taking over from that?
I do believe that something dramatic is happening here and in the rest of the world. when it was harder to travel around, when social media and communication were not what they are right now, and when the sense of cosmopolitanism was in its infancy, the idea of fully and exclusively acquiring English was single-sided and monolithic. Something dramatic happens in the 60s. There's bilingual education that is incorporated into many schools. Here in Florida is where it starts and it spreads to other parts of the country. There's going to be a backlash later on in the 90s against that bilingual education movement because it is describing immigrants as traitors if they didn't fully embrace the English language. And now, even though there is this emphasis and we speak English here, and if you don't like it, go back home, the reality is that the world has changed dramatically and you cannot afford any longer to be monolingual. It would be nearsighted. It would be counterproductive in terms of finding a job, in terms of furthering your education, in terms of connecting with other parts of the world.
So, you've studied American literature. Is American literature becoming more open to other languages besides English?
Absolutely. English language American literature is becoming multilingual literature in multiple ways. One way is that there used to be a time, Steve, where if you publish a collection of poetry and you included non-English language words, the publisher or your editor would ask you to put a glossary at the end because you needed to help the reader understand what this word in Quechua or this word in Russian means. That such approach now in publishing feels condescending. Mm. It is left to the reader to find out what that Russian word means or that Quechua word means. So at the level of single words, we see them much more often. They are not italicized the way they used to be. And then there's the fact that there are books now that can switch to another language and then come back to English easily when there's a scene in Spanish and without necessarily translating the whole thing. Uh-huh. So there is a welcoming for or other languages that wasn't there before. Mm.
We've recently lived through some interesting times and interesting changes in the valorization of indigenous languages, not just in the United States, but around the world. Talking about the United States, English is sometimes characterized as this dominating, colonizing force that suppresses and ghettoizes, minoritizes indigenous languages. We've been living with this concept for a few decades now. Do you ever see a revitalization of English in the sense of, well, did English do anything good for us?
Yeah. I'm very glad and welcome very much this question, Steve, because I think we have been witnesses and maybe also participants in single-sided approach to English as the evil force that has destroyed everything else. Truth is, the history of civilization is the Darwinian history of the survival and the perishing of languages. And at one point it was Hebrew, at another point was Greek, then was Latin, there was French, there was German. There is always one language that is at the top and other languages that are at the bottom. Languages to survive need to take over. And there's no language that has not done that. The Aztecs had the Nahuatl, and Nahuatl destroyed many of the languages through conquest, through slavery, and through other kinds of oppression. And yet, now that we look back at the indigenous past of Mexico, we romanticize Nahuatl as a benign language and Spanish as the destroying language. So English has gone through all this presentation as the evil empire. The truth is that English has been an incredibly versatile language that absorbs as it moves through the world. We don't have that Royal Academy that says, do not use this word. Mm. And because our dictionaries are descriptive dictionaries, meaning whatever word enters the language, the dictionary feels the duty to represent it instead of rejecting it like the French do. So I am hopeful though don't want to be naive, that we are entering a different period where we perceive English in all its complexity.
Let's go back 100 years, 150 years. A major challenge for the United States was literacy. Not that many people were literate. The standardization of English and teaching materials must have helped achieve literacy, don't you think?
Absolutely. The great story of English is the story of its democratic, pluralistic spirit. English is a language, as we were mentioning, that is spoken and written by millions around the world. This is for the first time in history. Latin was not spoken by millions.
At this point, I think it's fair to say billions.
Billions, absolutely, billions. Inside the Iliad and the Odyssey, there are no cases of people reading or people writing. Go to American literature, where we have Huck, where we have a new version of the runaway slave, Jim, that is all about reading and writing. And with reading and writing comes a multiphonic world where everybody has an opinion. It can feel that democracy can be oppressive as a result. It's too loud. It's too conflicted. It's too polarized. But we're all in it. We're all immersing ourselves in the complications of being a pluralistic and democratic society. And English has been, no doubt, the force that has given us that.
Since there is such a thing as American literature, I asked Elon what constitutes an American language.
An American language is the hush-posh, complicated means of expression that we use as Americans, and that it's never static, always changing, nurtured by the legacy of English, but fed through the many different immigrations and other types of journeys that we have had. It's an incredibly jazzy and creative and porous and complicated and fascinating language.
So there is an American literature and an American language. What about an American book?
What is an American book? Does the reader make the book American? Does the topic make it American? Is the fact that the author might or might be American also the one that ultimately decides? In my view, Steve, it's a sum of all of them. It certainly is the reader who is coming to the book that makes this an American book.
Elon knows a lot about translating literature. Last year, one of the titles from Restless Books, Elon's publishing house, was a finalist for the National Book Award in Translated Literature. It's a novel written in Arabic that was translated into English.
It's a Kuwaiti book titled The Book Censors Library.
I asked what the recognition from the National Book Awards meant for his team at Restless Books.
It felt like an acknowledgement. It felt like a celebration. It felt like an outburst of happiness to be able to say that, yes, this is as legitimate and as important as writing a novel directly in English.
The question that inevitably comes up is whether a book can be as good in translation as it is in the original language. Elon favors the original language, but it probably won't surprise you to hear that there's more to his answer.
But in no way this diminishes the value of the translation. Because translation is an interpretation, and any reading is an interpretation of a book. A book flourishes in translation. There are 25 different translations of Don Quixote into English, and I think you have 25 different ways of reading Don Quixote in English, whereas in Spanish you only have one. Consider translations. The currency that we need in order to travel to other languages when we don't know those languages firsthand.
And you grew up with Yiddish and Spanish and then English. You have two children yourself.
Yeah.
What kind of linguistic environment at home did you create for them?
My two boys, Joshua and Isaiah, are fluent Spanish and English speakers.
Do you have advice for minorities in the United States, or immigrants, let me say, in the United States, in terms of their language use? Yeah.
My advice is, on the one hand, endow your children with the immigrant languages that you have as much as possible, and in spite of the resistance they might show as children, and particularly as adolescents, though at the same time, do not get deluded on the idea that you're raising robots. They will run away from the language that you taught them, and if it's theirs in some way, they will come back to it in their own terms. You are not there to master them, but simply to give them the tools.
How do you make it theirs? Or how do they come to feel it is theirs?
There's only one way to do it. That's love. The love for the language. You show how beautiful that language is, how intricately and intimately connected it is to you, how empathetic that language might be, and how you can say things in that language that you can't say in other languages. And if you do that, that's enough.
Elon points to his own experience as a child having Yiddish pushed on him by his parents.
I thought my parents were doing a disservice. Teaching me Yiddish, the language that the Holocaust had practically erased? What a waste of time. It should have been taught German or French.
And then, when he was older, he realized the gift they had given him.
I thank them every minute of my life for having given me that, because it connects me with a heritage, with an ancestry that I needed to uncover on my own later on in my rebellion to fully appreciate.
So parents, here's a good approach for giving your children the gift of your languages.
Let us give them that gift of something that is valuable to us. And language is a treasure box that at some point they will open. But not all of them will open it in the same way. Not all of them will open it even at the same time. It might take one of them 50 years to recover something that was given. It might take one just a few years to say, this is what I wanted to do. Now I see it. Children, just like us, have a mind of their own.
My thanks to our America the Bilingual team who worked on this episode. Mim Harrison, our editorial and brand director. Fernando Hernandez Becerra, who produced the episode from his studio in Guadalajara, Mexico. Esto No Es Radio. And Jen Carvanaro at Daruma Tech, who manages our website. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please share it wherever you socialize. We welcome your feedback on the episode notes page, which you'll find on americathebilingual.com. Thanks for listening. Gracias por escuchar. For America the Bilingual, this is Steve Levine.